Welcome to Opinion Has It. I'm Elmira Bayrusley. The former KGB man in dark sunglasses, the shirtless leader riding a horse through Siberian mountains, the judo black belt training with the National Olympic team.
When the going gets tough, the tough go to Siberia and strip down?
Russian President Vladimir Putin has always cultivated a striking image of personal power.
Putin, the bare-chested hunter, discovering ancient treasure and riding Harley Davidson.
And, as Russia's longest-serving ruler since Stalin, he seems to have the credentials to back it up.
What they're looking at is a white, authoritarian leader who has murdered journalists and his political enemies, who runs a regime of repression, who makes aggressive moves against neighboring countries.
But Russia's economy is tanking, and protests are raging.
We begin in Russia, where over 3,000 people have been arrested during a second week of nationwide protests.
The protests rolled across 5,000 miles and 100 cities.
Russia will be free, they chanted.
Protesters also say they are marching against corruption and for more democratic freedoms in Russia.
Is Putin's position in jeopardy?
Hello.
Hi, Tim. I'm Elmira.
Nice to meet you.
Joining us today to help answer this question and demystify one of the world's most prominent dictators is Timothy Fry.
Thanks for the invitation.
Timothy is the Marshall D. Schulman Professor of Post-Soviet Foreign Policy at Columbia University and the author of the new book, Weak Strongman: The Limits of Power in Putin's Russia. He joins us from his home in New York. So, Tim, I want to start by addressing some common misconceptions about Russia. In your book, you criticize Western observers for reducing modern Russian politics to President Vladimir Putin's personal character. What does this approach get wrong?
We often learn that Putin's ex-KGB background is a really important thing for us to understand about why Putin does what he does. Other people look at Putin's harsh upbringing and say that that colors how he sees the world. Other people look at the kinds of books that he reads and make inferences about how he behaves based on what he reads. And my criticism of those views is that so much of what we see Putin doing are things that all autocrats do, whether or not they were in the KGB before, whether or not they're reading book A rather than a book B, or whether or not they had a prosperous or an impoverished upbringing. You know, people looked at Putin's kind of supposed lust for power as a reason why he extended his term in office recently, pushing through constitutional amendments that could allow him to stay in power until 2036. But if we look at every other autocrat in the former Soviet Union, Belarus, Azerbaijan, the five Central Asian republics, they've done the same thing with very different backgrounds. In Turkey, President Erdogan has done something similar. In Venezuela, Hugo Chavez also did something similar. So there's something more systematic that we miss when we kind of reduce politics in Russia to Putin's worldview.
So I'm just curious, what books does Putin read?
One author that is Ivan Ilin, who was a kind of a Russian anti-communist philosopher with sort of right-wing tendencies, who argued that Russia had a special path in the world. Putin has a soft spot for this author. But, whether or not these views changed how Putin thinks, or whether, the book just mirrors what Putin already thinks, makes it really hard to figure out whether the book has any real impact on how he views the world.
But focusing on Putin himself is just one way observers oversimplify Russian politics. Another is presenting Putin as a natural product of Russian history. From the Tsars to the Soviets, dictators have ruled Russia for centuries. But their approaches seem to follow a cyclical pattern. expansion abroad, and reaction at home.
This government has maintained the closest surveillance of the Soviet military buildup on the island of Cuba.
Followed by retrenchment abroad and reform at home.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
According to this narrative, Russia had its period of retrenchment and reform after the Soviet Union's collapse. Under Putin, it's reverting to its role as a great power.
One view says, look, you know, Russia's had a thousand years of autocracy, and, you know, we should expect it, you know, to continue on into the future. But even if we look at the last 100 years, autocracy in Russia has taken a variety of different forms. So, you know, Russian history is much more varied and doesn't really provide a clear guide to what we're seeing now. Also, we tend to emphasize those factors about Russia that are purportedly unique. The most common framework is to say that there is some kind of post-Soviet person who was so deeply influenced by the Soviet experience that there's the stereotype is Russians tend to be more apathetic, more cunning around power, and there's just really not much evidence for that. One of the favorite studies that I cite in the book is this study of lost wallets that were supposedly lost in 55 different countries. And researchers documented the rate at which the wallets were returned and how much of the money that was in the wallets was returned. And what they found is that Russians are about as honest as Canadians, Americans, and Brits. So there doesn't seem to be anything particular about the Soviet experience, at least in terms of how, you know, Russians' honesty has been impacted. Now, it's not, of course, to say that, you know, Putin's personality is not one factor or Russian history doesn't shape a lot of what goes on in Russia. The argument is more to say that we've really overplayed those factors at the expense of more general, more systematic factors.
Tim, you call Russia a personless autocracy. How does this differ from other autocratic regimes? And what unique constraints do personalist autocrats typically face?
For a long time, you know, we used to just lump all non-democratic regimes together. And in the last 20 years, political scientists have made a lot of headway by recognizing that there's a big difference in different types of autocratic regimes. For example, one-party regimes, as we see in Vietnam or China or in the Soviet Union, and military regimes like we see in, you know, Myanmar or in Pinochet's Chile, behave very differently from personalistic regimes where you have a single leader whose decisions are unconstrained by another organization. And one individual who makes the main kind of policy and personnel decisions, as we see in contemporary Russia, you know, contemporary Turkey is another good example, Hugo Chavez's Venezuela. And we see that these types of personless autocracies, they tend to be more corrupt. They tend to have more volatile economies. They tend to grow more slowly than do military-led regimes and one-party regimes.
In order to stay in power, personalist autocrats like Putin must balance the interests of two groups, political elites and the public. Tim calls them dual threats, because both groups could end his rule, whether through a palace coup or a popular revolt. Right now, Putin isn't doing a very good job of pleasing either.
With chance of Putin as a criminal and freedom for Navalny, thousands of demonstrators are rallying throughout Russia.
These are scenes the Kremlin doesn't like to see.
We begin this hour with more than three dozen new Russian-related sanctions. The United States Treasury is targeting Russia's elites, including seven Russian oligarchs and 12 companies they either own or control, as well as a state-owned weapons company and a Russian bank.
A lot of these oligarchs are people very, very close to Putin.
But this wasn't always the case.
Now, in Putin's first decade in office, oil prices surged and the size of the economy doubled and living standards soared, unlike anything that Russia, you know, has seen in living memory for sure. And this allowed him to satisfy both the inner circle and the mass public. He didn't have to rely a lot on repression. There wasn't a lot of opposition to him concentrating more power in his hands. He could build up this powerful state media apparatus. These were, you know, the good times for Putin in these first, you know, first decade in his office. And we should give Putin credit as well, because he did manage this inflow of petrodollars into the Russian economy pretty effectively. And that can often be a challenge for countries with weak institutions.
But there were limits to Putin's strategy. In 2009, when Putin was prime minister, polls showed that only a minority of Russians believed their country's leadership was taking them in the right direction.
There is more political unrest tonight throughout Russia.
In 2011, Putin orchestrated what was obviously a fraudulent election in order to return to the presidency. Russians weren't happy.
Tens of thousands packed the streets of Moscow in the biggest anti-government demonstrations Russia has seen for 20 years.
Anti-Putin demonstrators of all ages came together to strike at the heart of power following allegations that Sunday's parliamentary election was rigged.
The protests eventually faded due to a combination of exhaustion and state-targeted repression. But the seeds of popular discontent had been planted. And by 2014, Putin's approval ratings were sagging. With Russia's economic boom reaching its limits, Putin had to find a new way to satisfy his dual threats. He settled on foreign expansion.
We turn tonight to the tension rising around the world as Russian President Vladimir Putin casts his shadow across the boundary of Europe and Russia.
Russian troops moving swiftly to take control of military bases in Crimea, where voters decided to rejoin Russia.
The referendum in Crimea was a clear violation of Ukrainian constitutions and international law, and it will not be recognized by the international community.
The move cost Russia economically, but Putin's approval rating soared.
Even those who had been skeptical about Putin, his approval ratings had fallen from the 80s to around the 60s. After the annexation of Crimea, his popular approval soared. And of course, the kind of hardliners within his inner circle were very happy to have Crimea, not just as a place to spend summers, but also for strategic purposes. Its location is important for, Russian naval activities, and it is an additional lever that the Kremlin can use to try to keep Ukraine weak and subjugated. And that basically bought him four more years of breathing space. But then, you know, at some point, the warm glow of the annexation has faded, and there's no new Crimeas around for Putin to, use again in order to bolster his popularity.
And people won't look past their economic well-being forever. Russia has registered no real growth since 2014. In 2020, the average Russian had 11% less to spend than in 2013. Tim, the disregard for Russians' economic well-being seems to be catching up with Putin. What Russia's economy really needs is structural reform. Why can't or won't Putin pursue it?
He could try to introduce broad-based economic reforms that would stave off the possibility of a popular revolt by, increasing living standards. But what that would mean is taking rents and benefits away from the inner circle who are benefiting so much from the status quo. So, what we've seen, I think, in the last 12 months or so is that Putin has kind of really thrown in his lot much more with the security services at the expense of promoting broad-based economic growth. Putin has created this economy that really privileges these very concentrated interests and discourages the kind of innovation and creation of private sector businesses, that would really go a long way toward improving living standards in Russia. There are real risks in Russia for being a growing, prosperous business, because that often makes you a target of larger rivals who often act in league with the security services. And Putin does some things to recognize that he does have to continue to deliver growth and that he does have to put some limits on the stealing. But the Russian economy just lacks the kind of dynamic, innovative growth that is really needed to bring the country from, you know, a middle-income country to a wealthy country. And the frustrating thing is that, you know, all the raw materials are there. You know, it's not that far from Europe. It has really well-educated populace. And, you know, one could see, you know, a much more prosperous Russia given a different set of policies than we see today.
We'll be right back. We know you've been alarmed and exhausted by the turmoil of the past year in the United States and all over the world. We saw outright lies fuel doubt in our elections and spark an insurrection. We saw international leaders like the US and the UK screw up their response to the global pandemic. And we're seeing strongman tactics threaten democratic institutions in countries like Brazil, India, and Hungary. At the same time, people have mobilized like never before to defend democracy, promote civil rights, and address the climate crisis. Does this fill you with a mix of anxiety and hope? There's a new podcast from the University of Virginia that's helping listeners to make sense of it all. It's called Democracy in Danger. Each week, hosts Will Hitchcock and Siva Vaidyanathan unpack the threats facing democracy and ask what we can do about it. They cover topics like successful protest movement with legendary activist Sirja Popovich, the radical idea of degrowing the economy with anthropologist Jason Hickel, and the terror of cyberstalking with MacArthur fellow Danielle Citron. Visit dendanger.org for more and subscribe to Democracy in Danger on any podcast app. With living standards declining, it's not surprising that popular frustration is bubbling up again. The latest wave of protests were sparked by the arrest and imprisonment of opposition leader Alexei Navalny.
The leading critic of the Kremlin, Alexei Navalny, has been detained by police after returning to Moscow for the first time since being poisoned with a nerve agent.
Prison officials claiming he had violated parole by failing to check in with them on multiple occasions last year, including while he was in Germany, even though he was there because he was recovering from the nerve agent poisoning that nearly killed him 6 months ago. Flashes of anger in Moscow tonight. After a court sent Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny to a prison camp for 2 years and 8 months.
Navalny has spent over a decade exposing the corruption of Putin's regime. Through slick videos, public demonstrations, and even a failed presidential run, his ultimate goal is to topple the Russian president and maybe even replace him.
These are people who are trying to steal my country. And I'm strongly disagree with it. I'm not going to be, a kind of speechless person right now. I'm not going to keep silent.
But Navalny has been a well-known opposition figure for years, and yet his following has only recently exploded.
Navalny comes to prominence in 2011 by being a minority shareholder where he sues these big state companies as a shareholder for violating corporate governance, and creates this movement to expose corruption within Russia. This does not make him a lot of friends in high places. And the Kremlin allowed him to run for the mayor of Moscow in 2013, where despite having many obstacles, he was able to get almost 30% of the vote, which was remarkable. He was able to build this nationwide group of offices that not only engaged in anti-corruption activities, but was also active in local politics. And no other politician had been able to do that. So Navalny's popularity is a very interesting question. In big cities like Moscow, he was popular. People knew who he was. But no government official until recently, would mention his name on the air. His name recognition was low in the single digits across the whole country for a long period of time. What public opinion of polling is available now suggests that around 20% of Russians support him. This support seems to be pretty committed. given that, you know, there are real costs now to being associated with Navalny. At the same time, Navalny has not broken through with a broader spectrum of Russian society. He has not also partnered or, you know, brokered coalitions with other opposition groups to create a broad, you know, anti-Putin front. And that has limited, you know, his political effectiveness. It's a very difficult environment to be an opposition figure. And one way to look at his 20% is to say, you know, a few years ago, he was at 5% approval ratings, and now he's at 20%. Another way to look at it is, oh, he's only at 20%. You know, why hasn't he, you know, broken through? And that's just very difficult to do in the current environment. And with the breakup of his organization, it's very uncertain, you know, what the future holds.
The breakup of Navalny's organization was effectively forced by the Russian authorities. And in many ways, this highlights Putin's increasingly harsh approach towards any opposition to him. You know, you can argue that Kremlin critics have often been poisoned or disappeared under mysterious circumstances, but the lengths to which Putin has gone to silence Navalny really seems particularly extreme. Is repression becoming Putin's preferred tool for holding on to power?
I think it's his least preferred, but I think at this point, the other tools are just not very effective, or he's concerned that they're not likely to work. I think Putin, like many of these autocrats, would prefer to rely on propaganda and performance and personal charisma. You know, these are just much less costly tools. But as the effectiveness of those tools declines, you know, the trump card for autocracies is always force. A common question that gets asked in Russian surveys is, name five politicians that you trust. And in December 2017, 60% of Russians offered up Putin's name. Now only about 30% of Russians offer up Putin's name as a politician that they would trust. The Kremlin does a massive amount of polling. They have a good sense of, you know, popular opinion. And I imagine that they're getting signals that, you know, his popularity is not what it was. Now, this is all not to say that Putin is going to fall from power tomorrow by any stretch, but it does mean that governing Russia is becoming a much more difficult task than it was in the easy days of you know, the annexation of Crimea and you know, economic boom of the first decade of the century.
Even with these growing challenges, Putin won't go down without a fight. Like any good personless autocrat, he knows that losing power is not an option, nor is it a particularly appealing outcome for his cronies.
If Putin were to lose power, so would all of the people in the inner circle, so would all of their children, so would all of their business partners. So one thing that's different in these types of personalist autocratic regimes is when there is a threat of losing power, there's no place for the ruler and the members of the inner circle to retire to in an easy fashion in the way there would be in a military regime or a one-party regime. And this can make transitions of power extremely difficult.
Tim, I want to end by considering the lengths to which Putin would go to hold on to power. From annexing Crimea to poisoning opposition leaders, we've seen what he's capable of. And in recent years, he's also established Russia as a foreign policy force. What kind of threat could Putin pose to Russia and the world if he feels cornered?
Putin has not generally used foreign policy as a tool to boost his popularity. The annexation of Crimea was a case where he chose the annexation, you know, for reasons having to do, I think, with more geopolitical reasons. And the great popularity followed as a second or third order effect. You know, there's some evidence from people on the, you know, kind of inner circle who were genuinely surprised by how popular the annexation was. And given how reticent a lot of the public is toward aggressive moves abroad, you know, it would be a really risky strategy, I think, for Putin to engage in a potential conflict. I mean, the trade-off for Putin in foreign policy is he wants to use anti-Westernism to solidify support among the elites, but he doesn't want to have a conflict. The public would not go for that. It would likely cause a lot of tension among the elites. You know, that would be a very risky strategy. Continuing to crack down, too, is difficult. Russia is a very well-educated country. It's a relatively wealthy country for a personalist autocracy. It's fairly urban. You know, countries where, you know, repression is the main tool for long periods of time tend to be poorer, tend to be rural, tend to be less well-educated. So it's a real dilemma, you know, for Putin. And I think this is one of the reasons why he's been reluctant to use the kinds of repression that we've seen, you know, in the last 6 months for the first 20 years that he was in power.
Tim, thank you so much.
Oh, this was my pleasure. I really enjoyed it.
That was Timothy Fry, a professor at Columbia University and the author of Weak Strongman, The Limits of Power in Putin's Russia. And that's it for this episode. Thanks for listening. We'd love to hear what you think about it. Please rate and review our podcast. Better yet, subscribe on your favorite listening app. You can also follow us on Twitter by searching for @prosyn. That's PROSYN. Until next time, I'm Elmira Bayrosli. Opinion Has It is produced and edited by Kasia Brusalian. Special thanks to Project Syndicate editors Whitney Arana and Jonathan Stein.